You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello, and welcome to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Thank you all for tuning in this evening. It's wonderful that you're all here. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs for the Library Foundation of LA. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is a nonprofit organization that provides vital support for Los Angeles Public Library and presents various programs, including the Aloud series, which you are tuning into this evening. The Aloud series is made possible through the support of the Library Foundation members. Thank you all for being here this evening. And if you're not a member, please consider joining by visiting lfla.org/support. Next month, Aloud will be presenting Claudia Rankine and Terrence Hayes, two tremendous poets. Members are invited to a private virtual reception before the program to enjoy a reading by Terrence Hayes and Claudia Rankine, a special video by her. So please, this will be a wonderful, wonderful event to go to. So join now. For tonight's program, which is part of the Power Series, and I hope you all have been tuning in to the Power Series, we will be discussing Deborah Spahr's new book, Work, Mate, Marry, Love, How Machines Shape Our Destiny, a title I see in two parts. First is the mantra that is put into all our minds as soon as we're aware of the world around us. The second being something we've all become increasingly aware of. Of course, machines have been shaping our destiny since the Industrial Revolution, but now more than ever, their influence guides our choices when it comes to both our professional choices and our personal choices. As Publishers Weekly so aptly put it, Spahr's explanations of how specific technology developed are lucid and insightful. Readers will take comfort in this clear-eyed assessment of humanity's ability to adapt to the technological change. That's a big word. I'm gonna look down here because their bios are so long and extensive and impressive that I will be facing down, so forgive me. I'm thrilled to introduce Deborah Spahr. You might remember her from her much talked about book, Wonder Woman, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. Ms. Spahr was the president of Barnard College, where during her tenure, she led initiatives to highlight women's leadership and advancement. She is now the senior associate dean of Harvard Business School Online, as well as being a teacher there. A prolific writer, Spahr's books include Ruling the Waves, Cycles of Discovery, Chaos and Wealth, From the Compass to the Internet, The Baby Business, and Wonder Woman, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. Her work covers issues of gender and technology and what affects the social structures of our lives. She'll be in conversation with the esteemed Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, the Chancellor's Professor at the University of California at Irvine. She's also the founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She is credited with helping to establish the shape the health law field. She directed the first ABA accredited law center focused on race and bioethics. Her books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood, Baby Markets, Money and the Politics of Creating Families, and Black Markets, the Supply and Demand of Body Parts. Please welcome these two incredible women. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jessica. This is going to be a wonderful conversation with a very good friend. So tonight we're talking about Work, Mate, Marry, Love, How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. See my copy here and my flags in them. Deborah, thank you for doing this. Thank you for being with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thank you so much for having this conversation.
Absolutely. So what the audience doesn't know is that we've just been gabbing behind the scenes in the green room, and they had to tell us stop a couple of times because we're just like going and going, just great friends being together. All right. So we've got a job to do tonight, but we're going to enjoy this.
Absolutely.
So I want to start off with asking you about why this book. What was it that motivated you, and when did you decide that you needed to write it?
So you know a little bit of the backstory, but of course our audience won't. So you and I for I think 20 years now.
Yeah.
Kind of the crazy ladies in the room who were writing about things like assisted reproduction and surrogacy markets, and you did more body parts than I did. But I think you and I caught on early to the fact that this sort of small portion of the world that was figuring out how to create babies through completely new technologies was actually hugely important. And so I did a lot of work in the reproductive space. I wrote a lot of other books about technological change. But what increasingly struck me, particularly during my time at Barnard, was that there's this whole literature on technology, and it tends to be pretty male. And it's not about reproductive technologies. It's about machines and building things and breaking things and disruption. And then there's this other whole literature on babies and love and women and sex. And those two literatures don't ever talk to each other. So the book was an exercise in bringing these two strands of thought together, partly just to be provocative, to be honest, but more importantly, because if you believe, like I do, and I think you do, that technology changes all parts of our lives, and if you believe, as I do, and I think most people do, that we're going through a massive technological shift right now, then we have to think about how the technologies of artificial insemination, artificial intelligence, machine learning, how they're going to change not only our economies, but our families, our intimate relationships, our humanity at its very core.
So before we get into the book itself, I'm curious about why you think that these worlds have not been stitched together before. You know, so the guys in the Tonka trucks, let's break it. And women who've been thinking about family, how you create it, how you manage it, and so forth. How come these worlds haven't come together? They have in your work, and in my work, but why don't we see more of it?
You know, it's a really good question. And I think part of it has to do, you and I are both career academics. You know, academics get incentives to go deep. And if you work on technological disruption, you really work on theories of technology. Whereas if you're a feminist and you're working on gender issues, you go deep there. So I think part of it is just how academia operates. The second part, and you know, at the risk of being somewhat arrogant, is you have to have kind of a leap of imagination to realize that what's happening inside the social media algorithms at Facebook are not just going to affect Facebook, but they're going to ripple out. And I think we're seeing that now. I predicted some of this stuff in my 2001 book, Ruling the Waves, where I said, gee, we're going to have some basic rules in cyberspace. I was kind of laughed out of the room, but I think that was the right thing to
but
do.
But now look at who's laughing.
Yeah, exactly. We should have had some rules in cyberspace, it turns out. But I think, you know, you don't often get brownie points for sort of stitching together things in improbable ways. But I also think there's a growing realization now because technology is moving so quickly. You know, you don't have to be a specialist in reproductive medicine anymore to realize that reproductive medicine is going to have revolutionary impact.
Huge. And in your book, you start off with talking about, in fact, the way that we lived before, and then there's what's happening now. And it's just fascinating, right? Because you there's the narrative also of your own journey too, the things that you found along the way, the student who really wants to meet with you while you're a president at Barnard, and then you find out the student's backstory, you're visiting robots in small communities and so much more. But why don't we start off with just the landscape that you talk about, the importance of the plow. What does the plow have to do with it? Like I'm thinking about Tina Turner, what's love got to do with it? And you spend this time talking about what the plow has to do with it. Help our, buy the book people and you will learn, but Deborah, tell us something about
it. Well, thank you. And actually the plow is critical. For years and years as I was writing the book, the working title was The Virgin and the Plow. Until my editor convinced me that there was no way they could put this out there, and there certainly was no cover they could come up with that worked. But the central argument is, let me step back a little bit. I'm trying to make this complicated argument that technology reshapes our most intimate ways. So if I want to have the reader's credibility in talking about how robots are going to change us and how artificial intelligence is going to change us, I want to make the argument that we've seen this relationship in the past, that in the past, when humankind has undergone these massive technological shifts, our human relationships have changed as a result. So I go back to what most people regard as the first great technological revolution, which was the plow. Now it seems hopelessly antiquated in 2020, but the plow was a revolutionary technology.
I mean, do young people today even know what the plow was, is?
They may. And I think, you know, to be less coy about it, when I talk about the plow, I'm talking about the shift to agriculture. And that is something that people understand. They read about it in, you know, third grade history. But for most of humankind's history, we were hunters and gatherers. That's how we lived. We lived as tribes. We didn't have private property. We didn't have permanent homes. And then inventors we will never know discovered ways of actually growing food rather than finding it. And that reshaped the world. Now, it reshaped the world over thousands of years. And it did many things. But the thing that I focus on is once you have settled agriculture, you have private property. And people need to know what their land is. And crucially, they need to know who their children are. Because children, for the first time in history, become economically valuable because you need them to farm the land and inherit the land. And in 8,000 BC, the only way for a man to know who his children were was to have sex with the certified virgin and ensure that she never had sex with anybody else again. And that, without any romance, is the origin of marriage.
Isn't that frightening in some ways?
It's deeply frightening. And I always have to issue the caveat that I've been very happily married for 35 years. As I told you, Michelle, one of my sons just got married this weekend on Zoom. So I'm a deep fan of the institution. But if you look at the origins of the institution, these are just the facts as we know them. It was a way to ensure the patriarchy, that men knew who their children were. And here's the part that's even scarier and really unfortunate, but marriage was a way of controlling women's reproductive powers, because with agriculture, women's reproductive abilities, which of course were rather mysterious in 8,000 BC, had to be controlled by the men of the tribe. And marriage was a way of controlling fertility so that women didn't go off and have babies with, you know, the enemies on the other side of the valley.
And we still, you know, it's interesting that you should say that, because we see those struggles still in our society today, right? If I don't want to fast forward 8,000 years, but to bring it, you know, into perhaps the most recent couple hundred years, let's say, in terms of a present, we still see that, right? I mean, that's part of the American agricultural story, the American capitalist story here too. Can you flesh that out just a little bit more, how we understand the plow within a more contemporary arc of maybe a couple hundred years?
Yeah, no, I mean, we were joking earlier that the plow is this ancient technology, but it's a technology that's been around pretty much all of the time. There was some brilliant work done by, sadly, my late colleague at Harvard, Alberto Alesina, who actually traced women's empowerment around the world and linked it to the development of the plow. So societies that never developed the plow, and there are still some, had more equal gender relations between men and women.
People need to know that.
I'm sorry?
I said people need to know that.
Yeah. It turns out that the move to agriculture was not good for women. The other sort of piece of anthropological evidence here is if you go back and you look at tribes that still live in the hunting-gathering way of life, women are responsible for about 50% of the calories.
Mm-hmm.
So women are equal economic producers.
Yep.
Once you move to agriculture, that the men become the producers of calories or wealth, and the women become the producers of children.
That's just absolutely fascinating. And of course, there are the sort of prurient ways that we saw that take shape in the new world here on American soil. When you think about agriculture and you think about race and family, and slavery plays such a critical role in that, right? You know, where do we see that more than just in that space, and Black women's bodies being used in the space of ownership, production, reproduction, all towards capital, and capital in a system that is so male dominant, where only wealthy white landed men can vote and basically have power in society.
Right. And without being too abstract about it, but if you're in a society where land has value, there's only two ways of getting wealth. Wealth comes to those who own the land, who's the plantation owners, and those who, and the other thing they need is they need the labor. So they need access to women's bodies to produce the labor. So you can't, and again, going way back in history, we know that slavery emerged at the same time as the agricultural revolution. So, so these things are all tied up in ways that we're only now beginning to, you know, hopefully start to disaggregate.
Yeah, I think that you're so right. And just touching on this point, that intersection of what we understood as technology at the time, because sometimes we get lost in that too. The plow was technology and agriculture in terms of what it developed as, right? That was its own technology at that time, this kind of new ways of doing it combined then with the old of needing people to do it. But your book is then about more than just that. Then it's also about this mating and this marriage. So what does marriage have to do with it? Why does marriage play a critical role? And, you know, in thinking about your New York Times piece that came out after the book, you wrote about Obergefell too, and the courts and this sort of interesting I'm just skipping here, but I just get to thinking of it, right? In vitro fertilization, gay couples, and how this technology of in vitro fertilization itself really revolutionized behind the scenes what we saw in front of the scenes, which is that the Supreme Court granting marriage equality because children of gay parents deserve just as much that their parents be married, if that's a version of a narrative. But then you said, you know, behind the scenes, what's happening is that gay parents were able to use these technologies to create the children that then the court would opine on. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right, so you've basically asked a question that takes the whole book into, you know, three sentences, but let me try. So let me start with sort of just a basic reminder that I suspect most people on this the webinar already realize. Marriage is a social construct. You know, there's nothing that's preordained about marriage as we've come to know it, which is a two-person heterosexual, presumably monogamous relationship. That's a construct. And I'm arguing that that was a construct that makes particular sense going all the way back to the time of the plow, because that's how you preserved stability for children. So you need, particularly, you know, during the time of the plow, you needed one man, one woman to produce a child, and then to ensure the health and stability of that child, you wrap them in a particular unit. So marriage was a bundle that made great sense for so long as the only way we could make children was through sexual intercourse. So now fast forward to 1960s, 1970s, which is the first time in human history that we really learn how to make children in ways that don't involve sexual intercourse. And as you and I would both agree, because we've been looking at this stuff for so long now, this is a really big deal. So if you think about the technological changes we're living through, yeah, Twitter's a big deal, but it's 140 characters. I mean, in the history of the world, it's really not such a big deal. But in vitro fertilization,
huge.
This is a huge deal. Donor eggs, donor sperm, the new technology of in vitro gametogenesis, this changes the world as we know it.
PGD, right?
PGD, you know, we are now creating our children increasingly through non-sexual means. We are increasingly using technologies that enable us to have the children, not because of some happenstance of which egg met which sperm, but because we have handpicked which genetic mutations we want our children to have and not have. This is going to change the face of the world. And it's going to do many, many things. But the thing that that I dwell upon in part in the book and in the article is that it is assisted reproductive technologies that have paved the way for gay couples to become parents. And if you read the court cases carefully, you can see that the major reason that allowed the courts to find in favor of same-sex marriage was in fact that same-sex couples had become parents. Now, one could argue, and I would argue, that the courts could have decided same-sex marriage on human rights grounds, but they didn't. They decided them based on the precedent of the best interests of the child. So if you look at that history, it was assisted reproductive technologies that helped pave the way for the legalization of same-sex marriage.
So, you know, what's interesting with that is that these technologies are new, but in some ways, societies have adapted even when they didn't have what we know of as in vitro fertilization, right? It's easier to think about the story of Moses, right? You think about, you know, before, and even now there's some stickiness around IVF, right? So there's still aspects of secrecy, families that don't want their kids or relatives to know that they've used these technologies. But in some ways, it's not new in that, you know, families bringing children into the world with a different, you know, sperm provider than the person who the child grows up with as dad, right? That part isn't new. But you are right that gay couples are using these technologies. Heterosexual couples are using these technologies. And I want us to talk a bit about the ethical challenges that people present, right? Because there are people who see your book and say, oh my gosh, what is she talking about? This is the brave new world on steroids. How do you respond to folks who say that, well, isn't part of what's here in the book an advocacy for something that's unethical, that engages in utilizing wombs all around the world, because sometimes American couples now go abroad to India and other places in order for them to get the treatments that they would like to have in order to have another child and so forth. And there's some people that say, well, we really need to sort of pause on that. What's your response?
So this was, you know, as you know, the book that I wrote in 2006 was called The Baby Business, which was purely just on the reproductive market. This book bundles the baby business with the robot business and the online dating business and a bunch of other things. But my argument is the same for all of these technologies, which is, I think I start from a position of what I think of as realism, which is that technologies evolve. We have very little historical evidence to suggest that once we humans create something, we put it back in the genie's lamp. So reproductive technologies are going to expand. Robots are going to expand. Artificial intelligence is going to expand. So rather than sort of sitting on the sidelines and saying, woe is me, which I don't think is helpful, and rather than saying, gee, I wish these technologies would go away, which I think is impossible to imagine, my position is let's use our imagination. Let's try to see where these technologies are going, and then let's put some rules around them. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, this is what I argued in my 2001 book, Ruling the Waves. That was the whole title. That even back when I wrote that in 2001, you could see that the internet was exploding, mm-hmm. and it was exploding in an environment that had no rules around it. When I wrote the baby business book, reproductive technologies were exploding, but there's essentially no rules around them. So I think there are bad things that you can do with these technologies. You know, no doctor should implant 8 embryos in a single woman's womb.
Not a woman, for our listeners, 100 children.
But I say, let's look into the future and then figure out how we want to put some guardrails around it, rather than just saying, let's not deal with it because it raises tough issues.
Well, in fact, to that point, with our early work in this area, that was a part of just naming what this actually is, right? It's just the narrative of donation when talking about people who are actually being paid for providing sperm and providing ova or for renting their wombs. And the resistance, you know, 15, 20 years ago when we first met, to naming that as it was, because there's just something that seemed to be violative, if some would say, of personhood, to name it as it was. But the failure to name it then just ignores all that comes with it.
Exactly. And I think, and this is an area I know less about, but I think we're starting to see some of that same dynamic playing out around robots.
Let's talk about robots, because you went to visit a robot that you described as being rather clunky, but it was a pretty picture of Bina in here. So tell us about Bina and your visit to this very small town with about, 1,700 people?
And 1,700 people and one robotic torso. But Bina is a robot that's being built to replicate a currently living woman. There is an actual woman named Bina Rothblatt, and her wife, Martine Rothblatt, who adores her, is trying to build a robotic version of Bina so that when the real Bina dies, there will be an animated version to sort of live on and carry on her life, her memory, her spirit, whatever you want to call it. And I did go visit the Bina, and it's so funny now, because when I first started talking about this visit, I would show a picture of Bina. And, you know, Bina only exists from the torso up, but right now we're
kind of like us in Zoom, right? Like that's us, right?
An avatar. And I wouldn't know, because I only see you in what is now a digital reconstruction. Exactly. So I, you know, the current Bina, the robotic Bina, he's a little clunky, you know, she feels a bit like a Disney animatronics, but as I spoke to her, you know, over the course of a morning, at some point I asked a question about her father, and it clearly just set her off. And she
did. You talked about that. So can you give us any behind the scenes?
Well, she didn't like her father. She had issues with her father, as, you know, many people do. I saw that spark, and it reminded me in some very odd way of, you know, what it must have felt like to see the first Model Ts coming off the assembly line. You know, they were clunky, they bellowed smoke, they didn't drive very well, but they were the face of the future. And that's how I felt when I was interviewing Bina and this Japanese robot, a Pepper, and a seal robot, Pero, that, you know, they're clunky, you know, they're early stage. But, you know, look at how many people have Siri as a constant presence in their homes. How many of us rely on our smartphones as, you know, on our bodies, that we talk to our smartphones first thing in the morning, last thing at night. We have already accepted robots into our intimate lives.
Something that came to mind, not high level, but just mid-level girlfriend talk, as if we had our wine glasses. Why are so many of them based on the sort of character and name of women? Right? I mean, what's with that?
Yeah, well, some of it is conscious. So for example, Paro, who's one of my favorite robots, he's a seal robot. His inventor consciously went for something that was non-gendered. So you don't know the gender of seal. He also used a seal because none of us has had an intimate encounter with a seal. So we don't have preconceived notions. When you look at the more sort of mainstream robots, the Siris and the Alexas, yeah, they're all female. And there's this goes back to how we should be thinking about this. That's probably a problem in the making. Mm-hmm. There are a number of people, in fact, so Bina, the robot, and the real person is African American. Yeah. And so the person is Black, the robot is Black, and they've actually brought in consultants to make sure that her speech patterns and her biases are not white. Mm-hmm. And these are exactly the kind of things that we want to be thinking about, because if you accept that robots will become an increasing part of our lives, you don't want the robots to be biased.
No, you don't want the robots to be
submissive.
Okay, and that's also an issue that's come up too, right? It's who are the people that have access to the technologies behind the scenes to train the people who are engaged in the technologies? And what does all of this mean in terms of sex roles and stereotypes that play out in society?
It's not a pretty picture. I mean, if you look at where most of these technologies are being hatched, pun intended, you know, they're being hatched in Silicon Valley with a lot of young white men.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and one sees that. I was surprised to see the Black woman Bina here in the book. So what will be the role, do you think, of law in this regard? Because Bina looks very smart, very sharp. It looks like she has some pearl earrings on as I'm looking at it, a cute haircut and all of this. But for many people, when they think about many, I don't know, but probably a number of people, robot sex robots. Men have had robots for, you know, a little while now and used primarily for sex. What's the role of law in regulating any of this? Is it, you know, it's your property and you do with it whatever it is that you want?
Perhaps, well, why not? These are the questions that I really think we societally need to be thinking about. The Europeans seem to be ahead of us. So there are a number of programs in Europe that are starting to think about the rights of robots. Now, as soon as I say this, people smile, right? It seems very science fiction. Yeah, everyone does. But I think, I don't know what those rights should be, but I think it's a question that we should start thinking about. We may not be able to answer it tomorrow, But I think we should start saying, you know, first of all, what do we want these robots to be and to do? How much autonomy do we want? Do we want to start programming into them? And insofar as we're going to grant them autonomy, what are the rights that go along with that autonomy? If men have, or men or women, more frequently men, if men have sex with robots, what is that? I mean, is that you know, an advanced sex toy, or is that prostitution? I don't know what the answer is, but I think these are the kinds of questions that one can answer. People always sort of throw up their hands because it sounds so absurd. Just as with assisted reproduction, they said, oh, it's all bad. But you can draw lines in the sand. And that's, so I'm a huge fan of law that would start, you know, carving our way through this.
Well, in fact, I mean, one could think about it with the sort of women's rights and women's greater autonomy and liberation around sex too. One might say that sex toys are versions of robots themselves that women are already using, so that maybe the market isn't just men, but women have already entered this market too. And how much about regulation relates perhaps not to the object itself, but how we see ourselves as a society, right? So in which side are we policing? Sort of policing the protection of the robot, or more thinking about, well, what are our social values around these kinds of engagement? And when is it that the state goes too far? Do we want the state to stay out of the bedroom in that way?
Right. And, you know, these are questions for which there's no easy answer, but I revert to a super easy example, which is the automobile. So automobiles are one of the most important technologies, you know, of the past few centuries. When automobiles came out, A, they were playthings for the rich.
Yeah.
And B, there were no rules. Yeah. You know, so you drove them wherever, you drove whatever speed, they broke down, there were no rules. But once the Model T becomes an item for mass consumption, then you need rules. And you don't need rules that go so far as to say, you can have a green car and I can have a blue car and you can drive it on Tuesdays and I can drive it on Thursdays, but you need speed limits, you need roads, you need stoplights. Yeah. And so that's the way I think about these things. The US is very bad at regulating. We don't like regulating. But in each of these areas, it's not rocket science to imagine some basic guardrails. Mm-hmm. I like that word better than rules or regulation. And think of social media. If we had had a serious conversation outside of academic circles in the mid-1990s, it wasn't a huge leap to say, maybe individuals should own their own data. I remember people arguing that. Anne Branscombe was arguing that in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
If we had decided as a society that let's start by giving people control, property rights over their own data, we would be in a much better position.
Property rights over their own body. You know, I think about the case of Moore v. Regents, a person who had a very unique cell line, hairy cell leukemia, and unbeknownst to him, his doctor was utilizing what he thought were medical treatments. The doctor was using his genetic material, sperm, tissue, et cetera, in order to create a patent based on this person's cell line. And when he ultimately sued, the court said, you know, look, you don't own your own body. You don't own your cells.
Yeah,
exactly, because there's no law there. Now, I must take a PSA break here to just say to our viewers and listeners, if you have a question, then please place it in the Q&A. So right now, if you have questions, do that, because otherwise Michelle will continue to talk to her friend and this will go long and late because we are just going to have a really good time here. So I want to turn to thinking about another issue that comes out of these times about how people are, not just view themselves, in terms of a sex spectrum, right? Non-binary. And you talk about in the book both historical cases of individuals who sought the technologies of surgery in order to become the people that they always were born into, right? Sort of born male, but always wanting to be a woman and having the amputation of a penis and so forth. But then today, the technologies are different and how people recognize themselves and can use testosterone in order to adjust who they are biologically and meant to be tell us a little bit about that journey, because you talk about it both as a president of a college, a university, and then also historically.
Yeah, so this chapter is a bit of an anomaly in the book. It's the one that I found people are least interested in talking about, so I'm very glad you raised it. But I think, just like I thought assisted reproductive technologies were a big deal 20 years ago, I think the fight for transgender rights is one of the most important things happening right now. It's massively controversial, but I think one of the reasons it's so controversial is that there's something so fundamental about changing genders that it makes progressive people embrace it and it makes conservative people hate it. And as you alluded to, we sort of figured out, we unlocked the secret of gender and the ability to change gender back in the 1920s. And there were sex reassignment surgeries done, particularly in Austria and Germany. But when the Nazis came into power, they destroyed this science. And that very famous photo, I have it in the book, of the book burning. People don't know, the books that were burning were from the Institute for Sexuality. Mm-hmm. Because as I say in the book, you know, once you get rid of the binary, there's nothing to hold the future back. So conservatives have this violent reaction to the whole issue of sort of evolving the binary. And I'll just do this really quickly. But I think if you look at people, even of my generation, and certainly older than my generation, the binary boy, girl, man, woman is just the first thing we know. It's, you know, it's literally what we know before we can speak. If you look at kids now who are in their 20s and in their teens, their notion of gender is far more fluid than ours is. You know, particularly if you live in LA or Cambridge or New York, any 18-year-old has kids in their school.
That's
who
were right.
Boys then became girls or vice versa, or they're in the middle and they're theys. And I think this is hugely important, not just because I think that the gender binary will start to morph in very important ways. But I do think once you get rid of that, or you allow the binary to be modified, kind of everything else becomes more fluid as well. And so I'll just end this with one anecdote. The woman who is building the robotic version of her wife, Bina, that woman, Martine, used to be a man. Martine Rothblatt was born Martin Rothblatt. And she is one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And when you talk to Martine, she says, if I could move from a man to a woman and still be the same person, I can see myself moving from a human to a transhuman. Mm-hmm. So there's something about that fluidity of gender that allows us to think about the fluidity between humans and post-humans in a way that becomes both more plausible and perhaps even a little bit less scary.
Well, and the less scary part, I think what you're also touching on is something that we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, which is human autonomy, the ability to be an independent person within one's own skin and life and live one's own rich identity and create one's own path, right? We think about that with regard to women and that control being stripped of them, Black women on plantations and that being stripped of them. And this is just a part of that continuing arc. Who gets to decide about somebody's humanity and independence? So we're going to start with Q&A in just a little bit, but if you do have questions, then please do put them in the chat. And so I'm wondering then how you see the future. So we talked about the past, we talked about what's happening now, and there's so much more that's happening now. But what does the future hold for us as we think about these issues? Parenting, mating. I mean, even right now, you have a son who just got married over Zoom. Who would have thought of such a thing 5 years ago? If we had been, you know, at your condo in New York, having some wine 5 years ago, and you're like, oh, guess what, right? Or if you had said, you know, guess what, Michelle, I think that, you know, one of my kids is going to get married by computer 5 years from now. I'd be like, what are you talking about, Jennifer?
If we had said that in December, we wouldn't have believed it. So as I'm fond of saying these days, the future is crashing into us. So our lives have moved into the digital world. Those of us who never played video games and didn't even spend a lot of time on screens, our lives are on these screens now. We are having book tours, weddings, funerals, dates, sex, everything that used to be in the virtual world. has migrated online. And that's happened in 6 months. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And I don't think we will ever fully go back, even if miraculously a vaccine were to come tomorrow, which it's not going to. Our lives will be forever transformed by this moment of COVID. But of course, I wrote the book before COVID was even, you know, on anywhere close on the horizon. So I think COVID will accelerate things, but these trends were strongly underway. And I think, I mean, there's so much here, but I think the my biggest concern in the short term about the future is that all of these technologies are going to exacerbate inequality. Because insofar as technologies will give people the ability to pick their children, the ability to live longer lives, the ability to have robots that they want to fall in love with, all of those things will go to the rich and not to the poor.
That's right. I mean, who benefits and who's harmed by this? Because just as we talk about technology, even during COVID, and we think about something like facial recognition, right? And many are deeply concerned about facial recognition because of, one, the flaws in the technology. And when there are technologies that are flawed like that, the people who often suffer the consequences happen to be the most vulnerable and people of color in the United States.
And sadly, this is only going to I mean, even before you get to the more science fiction-y part of this, you know, the first thing that's going to happen, which again, COVID has accelerated, is all of the manual labor jobs are going away.
Yeah.
Is anyone ever going to build a meat processing plant again that uses humans rather than robots? No. So we are going to see millions and millions of jobs in this country and every country wiped out. And that's again with sort of the boring technology. That's with machine tools. Then you start adding in... you know, paralegals, accountants, heaven forbid university professors, but, you know, even us, right? You got one good guy on Zoom and nobody else needs a job anymore. So we are going to see massive shifts in employment patterns. And they're, as everything, they're going to attack the most vulnerable first. I also think they're going to attack men in more ways than women, although I know women have been, because truck drivers, car drivers, you know, when driverless cars come around, those are mostly male jobs, about 3 million in the US alone. And we don't have an alternative identity for men to fall back upon. And so I already-
What are you predicting there, right? I mean, so now we're really getting deep into the wine. So what happens when-
Water.
Same here, right? Okay, you see how much her water, my tea. But- So what's your sense in terms of what happens culturally when men are then shut out of the workplace in that way?
Well, it's very dangerous. I mean, we know that there are few things more dangerous than having large numbers of unemployed, desperate men. Mm-hmm. They revert to tribalism. They revert to fascism. They revert to violence. And I think we're seeing this. And, you know, I think a lot of the sort of issues that are blamed on immigration or other, you know, feminism at heart, these are issues that are being driven by technology. Mm-hmm. I think the only politician, and I don't mean to get political here, but I think the only politician who's at least addressed these issues enough to worry about them is Andrew Yang. Mm-hmm. Coming from Silicon Valley, has realized that the societal impacts of technological change are going to be vast. There are ways to address this, things like universal basic income. They're complicated. But once again, my plea is let's think about these issues before they erupt in dangerous ways.
And some of them we can see on the horizon. I'm going to start us with a question from the audience and remind the audience that if you would like to get in the queue for a question, then please post it. But we do have a question that, can you speak to how technologies like Match.com, Tinder, and others have shaped gender, marriage, and such. And this reader is up to that part in your book, but would love to hear more of your thoughts on technology's impact on relationships.
Yeah, so I think online dating technologies are another very big deal. That's why there's a whole chapter on them in the book. You know, people my age who aren't dating any longer tend to look at these things and we're sort of vaguely titillated that we think, oh my goodness, everybody's having sex all the time. But that's actually not what's happening. In fact, there's a couple of things really important things that are happening as a result of these dating technologies. And again, all of which I'm sure are happening much faster and in greater numbers because of COVID. Because right now, if you're dating, you're dating online. there are no bars. You know, there's no dances. There's nothing but Tinder. There's a little bit of good news coming out of online dating. The numbers of interracial relationships are going up. And the people who look at this say they can't explain it by anything other than online dating. Because when you meet people in your social circles, you tend to meet people of the same race. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you meet people online, you actually expand your social circles. And so we're actually getting more mixed race, mixed ethnicities, mixed religion, which I think is a great idea. What we're also seeing, though, is we're seeing increased asymmetry. So if you go back again to the old model of, you know, the village matchmaker, in the old village, everybody got matched because the matchmaker paired everybody up.
That figured doesn't it all out. Yeah,
it worked out, right? And quite frankly, you know, when the only way you could have sex was through marriage, everybody had an incentive to get married, you know? So the social structure of the monogamous marriage and the village matchmaker worked. On Tinder, the matching doesn't occur so quickly. Or in many cases at all. What we know, and this feeds into the stereotypes, but the data bear it out, men are much less picky than women. So essentially, men swipe right on kind of every woman. And I'm just talking in heterosexual relationships for the moment. Women are much more discriminating in terms of who they want to have sex with, at least. So what happens is that some men wind up getting all the swipes. So if you are deemed attractive on Tinder, yes, you can have lots and lots of sex. But if men are deemed unattractive on Tinder or any of the sites, they basically find themselves without sexual partners.
Well, you know, I mean, given the prior question, and I'm going to go on to this next question, but that relates to the toxic masculinity rise of incels, right? People who are using the technologies to talk about how offended they are that there are women who are not interested in them and not dating them. And we've seen violence that has resulted from that. I wish we had a whole different session for that. But here's a question. Has your research shown a geographical difference in these emerging technologies? The questioner wonders whether societies with different political economic systems from Western capitalism have different needs from that are borne out with their technologies.
Yes. You know, the short answer is yes, absolutely. The long answer is very long. But if you think of a place just like China, for example, very different cultural norms and very different governmental norms. So China has regulations in place. They have restrictions in place. So some of the inequalities that I think are going to occur in the US and more capitalist systems, China will be spared. By the same token, China is also embracing sort of online relationships at a faster rate than the United States. And if you look at Japan, people are sort of opting out of physical sex and physical relationships in much greater numbers. And they're choosing to have relationships with avatars instead of with actual human beings. And that's not sex with robots, it's just having emotional relationships with non-human beings. So there's very big cultural differences here.
So let me add on to that before they make us close out, which is, you know, what's the role of the emotional in this future that you describe in the book and that you analyze in the book? Some might say that it's dystopic. And on the other hand, you say, well, look, this is coming. I'm just naming what is coming. So how do we emotionally relate to this? I know that's big, but...
So the title of the book is Workmate, Marry, Love. And when I sort of write in the closing chapter and I sort of go through those categories, there's a reason I save love for last. And maybe I think I probably am a romantic at heart, despite this sort of strange work that I do. But I don't think technology changes love. I think we are biologically hardwired, emotionally programmed to seek human relationships. And again, I think COVID is bringing this into relief because I know very few people are saying, God, this is great. I never want to see another human being again. So good, I don't have to hug people. You know, we are craving that human relationship, whether it's sexual, romantic, for our children, for our friends, for our colleagues. We crave human relationships. And I don't think that emotion goes away. I think the format that it takes goes away. I think marriage as an institution is going to be upended. I think we will reproduce our children in fundamentally different ways. but I think we will still love our partners, even if they're partners for different periods of time. I think we will love our children. In fact, I think we love our children so badly that that's why we're seeking other ways to reproduce them. So I don't think love goes away. I just think the subjects of our love and the formats of our love are going to shift.
Wow. You know, what more can be said? That is a powerful way to conclude what has been a wonderful evening with you. Our viewers, our listeners are absolutely so fortunate to have been able to have this time to focus on your book. I don't know if folks can see that right there, but Work, Mate, Marry, Love, How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. I couldn't have been more happy than to spend this time with you, Deborah.
Well, and thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure to have a conversation, and we will continue it in person with all of our listeners at some point. We'll get back to real life.
Exactly.
Thank you. That was an amazing, amazing conversation. I could have listened to it for another hour. It was just fantastic. And to our members and to those who are joining us for the first time this evening, thank you. If you'd like to see more programs like this one, please consider being a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Go to lfla.org/support. We loved having you this evening. Thank you so much for being here. And please remember that on November 15th, we have three terrific poets coming. Claudia Rankine, Terrence Hayes, and Dawn Lundy Martin. Thank you so much for being here, and good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.